Hello, everyone, and welcome to Negotiating Ideas, a podcast about political thought on democracy, pluralism, and peace. This is Omar Sadr, a senior research scholar at the University of Pittsburgh Center for Governance and Markets. As we are getting close to the second anniversary of the Negotiating Ideas podcast in July, and the third anniversary of return of the totalitarian Taliban regime in Afghanistan, the podcast aims to initiate a second season with a focus on the state of Afghanistan and exile scholars in the U.S. Since the fall of the Republic of Afghanistan, numerous academics have fled the country in fear of persecution. Most of these scholars are welcomed in the U.S. academia in the framework of a two-year or three-year fellowships funded by either a Scholars Q Fund or a Scholars at Risk program or independent initiatives of universities. In a new academic environment, they not only find opportunities but also several challenges in terms of their career. The second season of the podcast will provide them the opportunity to speak about academic persecution in Afghanistan and their status and challenges in the U.S. academia. Today, I'm truly privileged to have with me two distinguished scholars, Dr. Mirwais Balkhi and Dr. Bashir Mubasher. Their journey as a scholar at risk have been marked by tremendous resilience and unwavering commitment to their academic pursuit. I welcome both of you in today's podcast. Welcome.
Thank you, Doctor.
Let me start by asking each of you first to tell the audience, how do you see yourself as an academic in exile? Most of the audience may not be aware of your academic journey in Afghanistan. Dr. Balkhi, you have been teaching, apart from your other portfolios that you had as a diplomat, as a politician, as a minister, you are also an academic. You are teaching at universities, you conducted research, you guided students. Now you find yourself in the U.S. How is that? How do you define yourself as this transition, probably?
Thank you very much, Dr. Umar. You have said well, because I have always tried to express my academic identity than bureaucrat, because I believe I'm more suitable to that academic circle than the bureaucracy and administration, which is a time-bound responsibility. So my long-term commitment is always to the academics, especially on Afghanistan and in Afghanistan. For me, I'm student of regional studies. So every region individually is a unique world, talking about the abstracts, talking about the characteristics, talking about the index, talking about designs, formats, or whatever. So that is why in Afghanistan, at least as a university professor, as a researcher, as a chief editor of the journals, and as an analyst, I was kind of defining my academic identity. And I was, I would say that I was well established in Afghanistan academic circle, because I knew where is my position and where I'm going to in the future. So my displacement, I always use fugitive scholar and not scholar at risk or exile, because I'm subjectively made this decision to leave the country because of certain risk for the survival. Sure. So now what I feel is totally disconnected from my laboratory and from the ground that I was looking for to see and use my expertise and my knowledge. So that is what my feeling is as a fugitive scholar.
Got you. So now let me turn to Dr. Bashir Mubasher. So you have been teaching at American University. We were colleagues over there. And then as security situation got worse, you also decided to leave the country. And currently you are a postdoc at Washington University, American University, apologies, in D.C. How about you? How do you define yourself? Do you consider yourself as a scholar in exile, at risk, or as Dr. Balkhi characterized it differently?
Well, first of all, thank you very much for inviting me, and it's an honor to be with you and Dr. Mirwais Balkhi. We have had collegiality at the American University of Afghanistan, so it's great to see you again. I sometimes consider myself as a scholar. Sometimes I consider myself as a scholar in exile. The term scholar in exile, basically, to me at least, it suggests that you're no longer able to stay in your country and to teach in your country and do research in your country, or you're going to be persecuted because of your values, because of your ideas, so you have to flee the country and you're no longer safe inside your own country. Now, the use of the term of scholar in exile has its own perks and disadvantages. The perk is basically to draw the attention to what's going on in Afghanistan. Once you say that I'm a scholar in exile, that everyone knows that there is something wrong going on in the country, and you automatically draw attention to the atrocities that are happening by the Taliban against the academia. But at the same time, it has some disadvantages as well, because in terms of finding jobs in the market, when you refer to yourself as a scholar in exile, the idea is that you are an alien scholar or a scholar who's not from the United States or from Europe or London. Mm. And therefore, the opportunities are much lower because they think maybe you're not qualified for the job and for the position. So you have to try even harder about that. So, yes. That's my answer. So sometimes I define myself as scholars in exile. Mostly I would do that because I want to draw attention to what's going on in Afghanistan. But sometimes I also refer to myself as a scholar only.
Okay, so you pointed to a very good issue, which is navigating academic job market in the U.S. also presents certain challenges. So now I want to ask both of you, how did you find yourself when you arrived in the U.S.? What sorts of disparities did you realize defining your new position here? So, Dr. Balkhi, you are at Wilson Center. It's a think tank, which is, of course, not following certain rules, norms that universities does. But if you situate and define as how is the new context for you?
So what I believe is that in Afghanistan, the academia and the think tanks, the whole academics have been different, not only in Afghanistan, I believe in the region of Afghanistan, even in India, in Pakistan, in Iran, in many countries. What I have been in close contact, and also I had experience of being in these countries. Because if we look at the position of the academics in our region, we are, I always say that in the third development of the political science and international studies in our region, because we are in a position to define certain knowledge or to create certain knowledge for our societies and then work on that for the implementation on our society. But when I came here in the US, before that I was also as an adjunct professor in Georgetown, Qatar. So those experiences when I was in close contact again, I saw a big difference between the academics in the US and the think tanks in the US and ours in Afghanistan, because we were skilled based on certain capacities, certain requirements, and certain methods and designs in Afghanistan. We were mostly focused on qualitative understanding of the situation in the U.S., not now, at least since post-Second World War. They are mostly into scientific experimental school of teachings and also thinking. So it does not mean that we did not know about all these things. We were studying, especially I'm a student of IR, and IR is an American knowledge. You better know that even in India and Afghanistan, we were all going through the literature which were produced by the American.
Sure. So how about you, Dr. Mubasher? So here Balkhi is saying that how political science is more quantitative in the U.S. and qualitative in Asia and Europe. How did you find the difference, despite the fact I understand that you did your PhD in the U.S.? So you have a background experience of the U.S. So how much difference there is between disciplinary identity of political science or whatever subfield you associated with in Afghanistan and here?
Right, so I graduated from University of Washington School of Law, but when I did my PhD, I wanted to do like an interdisciplinary study. So the committee members I had for my dissertation included professors from law, political science, and sociology. And that's why when I graduated from School of Law, I did teach in the Department of Political Science with you, Dr. Omar, but also in the Department of Sociology as well. So I'm a little bit familiar with these three different disciplines. And I echo what Dr. Balkhi suggested, that there's a huge difference between the type of research we do, the quality of research we did in Afghanistan, and the method of the research we did in Afghanistan and in the United States. I was lucky enough to work with a few statistics and quantitative research projects. As you remember, at the American University of Afghanistan, I founded the American University of Afghanistan Survey Club, where I encouraged the students to engage in survey programs. So it was a collaboration between the professors and the students in terms of doing quantitative research project in the country. So I had a little bit of that experience in Afghanistan as well. To me, the biggest problem in terms of transition to the United States was the fact that we didn't prepare for the job market in the United States, right? So although I studied in the United States, both for my master's and my PhD, I never thought that I'm gonna stay and teach in the United States or I'm going to work in the United States. Everything I did was focused on the laws and politics of Afghanistan and some countries surrounding Afghanistan. So I basically prepared myself for a job market inside Afghanistan rather than a job market in the United States. And that was the problem for my transition to the United States, even though I studied in the United States. For example, I can't take a bar exam, although I graduated from law school, because I didn't take some necessary courses to qualify to take bar exam, right? So if I want to take a bar exam today, I still have to take a number of courses at the law school and pay a lot of tuition for that to basically be able to be eligible to take the bar exam. Mm-hmm. Or for example, in terms of academia, again, Afghanistan is, since the return of the Taliban, Afghanistan is no longer a prominent subject among the academics and researchers in the United States, because people and policymakers and almost everyone has lost a lot of interest in the country. So the product that that we're producing, the research projects about Afghanistan, it doesn't have a lot of audience now as it did, for example, before the return of the Taliban. So if you offer a class, for example, about Afghanistan or conflict and peace in Afghanistan, you get very few students because, again, the interest is no longer there. So the product has a little bit lost its interest in the market. So what we are offering also doesn't have like a lot of doesn't draw a lot of attention in the market. Let's put it that way.
Sure. So that really is an issue. I think all scholars, irrespective of whether they're from Afghanistan or not, they have to broaden their research interest, their research subject. Having a narrow, probably case study, particularly focusing on one country, has advantages, but of course it produces a lot of disadvantages. How is your experience, Dr. Balkhia, in terms of how the scope of your research has been since a long time you have been focusing on Afghanistan? How did you navigate that challenge in the U.S.? Did you also realize that you have to move beyond just a case study focus on Afghanistan or not?
Yes, but it usually takes a lot of time, right? Because, well, you're stepping into a new area, a new realm of research, so you have to study about communities, about the societies, about the politics, about all of it, so that you are able to produce a better quality research project. Because one of the things that we all have experienced is this production of knowledge about Afghanistan by some Westerners who are low quality because they don't know the language, they don't know, for example, the communities, so the research findings are mostly superficial. It doesn't present up.
My scope is divided in three levels since the beginning. I'm working on specifically on Afghanistan and then Middle Eastern studies, so non-Western international studies. So all three, when I came here, have been undertaken by the academia here in the United States. Not the Middle Eastern studies, but why it is again a limitation for me, because Middle Eastern has been an interest for all academia and think tanks here in the United States of America, and there are many people and experts from the Middle Eastern countries as well as the native experts from the U.S. They are working and focusing on certain issues of the Middle Eastern region. That is why, comparatively, when I saw, as Dr. Mubashir said, Afghanistan has been undertaken or a kind of not an, a focus interest nowadays based on the diversion of the foreign policy of the U.S. and different other global issues which are at the focus. And at the same time, Middle Eastern studies is also comparatively, when they look at us from Afghanistan, they're more expecting from us to think about Afghanistan or Afghanistan Central Asia, Afghanistan South Asia or AFPAC, different other topics which are facing kind of shortage of the expertise and all these things. Mm-hmm. And non-Western international studies is also not interested here to talk much about it. Although there are some universities, some of the projects working on this project, but it is not a major interest here in the United States of America. It's limited circles who are working on talking about non-Western IR. So that is why all three focuses that I have in academics, I have seen certain limitations on all of them. So for me, it would be, I think, a choice to think of Afghanistan and Middle East always, because that is the only aspect which has remained untouched.
What are certain form of support, both in terms of institutional support, but also personal support, the scholars in exile or scholars who are coming from conflict region in the US would require in order to coop up or catch up with the rest?
Yeah, well, first of all, I have to say that Afghan academics received enormous support from American institutions, but also institutions in Canada as well as in Europe. Particularly, they have provided a lot of opportunities in terms of fellowships and scholarships just to get a lot of Afghan scholars out of the country and offer them some support in terms of, for example, financial support as they stay at these different universities for at least to sustain themselves. And I think what support they need, particularly from these different institutions, is a little bit of more time, because 1 year or two is not enough for an Afghan academic who studied in Afghanistan or who did all their work and research projects inside Afghanistan to adapt.
So definitely you're suggesting that a long-term commitment or institutional support will provide opportunity for scholars to at least find their feet, navigate the market, build up their academic expertise, publish, and then go on to the job market. Definitely it is challenging in the US, and publications, it takes time. It's not easy. It's not just producing overnight. So you have to sit on a topic, and probably if you have a field work, that will take a longer time to do it. But now let me move on to another topic, which is academic freedom. I think core of your identity and those scholars who are in exile or at risk is the issue of academic freedom. It is not fear of persecution simply because of someone is threatening you as a person, but it's also about they're threatening your ideas, your thought, your freedom of expression. Any form of authoritarian state or many other non-state actors, probably those which in a conservative society, there are social actors which influence freedom of thought. I understand that there are challenges here in the U.S. also in terms of freedom of academic freedom. Universities are struggling since October the 7th. There are crises across U.S. academia. But let's talk about academic freedom. How did you feel it and experience the situation in Afghanistan, even under Republic probably? We try to sometimes tend to pin this black and white between the Republic and the Taliban. Of course, the Taliban are the total evil, but I also understand that situation under Republic was also not to the perfect as we would have expected in an advanced democratic society. So, Dr. Balkhi, let me ask you here now. How did you experience the situation for academic freedom under the Islamic Republic of Afghanistan and then the shift which happened in the Taliban and now that you are in the U.S.?
Well, in Afghanistan, there were many obstacles socially, based on social context of Afghanistan, fragility that we had in the past 20 years also. These have been always deterrents for an academic to freely express himself through writings or through lectures, because not only the government, but also there have been many unsolved issues which we had all sorts of obstacles, limitations to criticize, to attack, or to not allow anyone to say whatever he wants, because we have certain contracts inside Afghanistan which have been depending to a group of people or a group of identity or political parties, whatever. That is why in Afghanistan, though the government was kind of expressing itself to be free or giving freedom to the academia in Afghanistan, but we were much aware of ourselves, what terminology we have to use, what thoughts we have to use, what kind of critics we have to bond ourselves. So these all deterrences we had in our mind, that is why we were somehow trying to balance so that our expertise or our lectures, papers, does not create a chaos inside Afghanistan. Do I personally believe for a strategic...
What do you mean by creating chaos?
Chaos means it should not be kind of a strategic distraction, so that mm-hmm. we are destroying the whole belief system of Afghanistan politically, sociologically, or any other aspect, but then we cannot construct it. So that okay. was a major commitment that I had in Afghanistan.
What, do you consider that a kind of self-censorship for an academic
yes.
to consider
yes.
certain limitations?
Yes, that was a kind of self-censorship. I was telling myself or convincing myself commitment, because I knew that in Afghanistan, strategically, we are not constructing any aspect of the society, state, or nation. Mm-hmm. So that if we are destroying that part, then we can rebuild it. And that
so
is why...
Can you give an example of destroying which aspect of society, for example?
For example, when I was talking about international relations of Afghanistan, there have been historic hypotheses, for example, on foreign relation of Afghanistan with certain groups outside or certain countries outside the country, taking, for example, Central Asia or Afghanistan or Pakistan and Afghanistan, we have an understanding in the foreign policy literature of Afghanistan that there has been always a kind of offensive politics from Afghanistan side towards from Pakistan side towards Afghanistan.
Okay.
So when we were kind of analyzing that it is reverse, that the offensive politics of Pakistan towards Afghanistan has been always secondary. The primary issue is the fragility of Afghanistan itself. It gave space to the outsiders to follow the politics of or the geopolitical games in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
So here I was so much conscious that whether it is the reality, have we reached this conclusion that through a quality research, mm-hmm. we have reached this conclusion that yes, the fragility of Afghanistan has been always inevitable for outsiders to interfere in the domestic politics of Afghanistan. So I was kind of thinking not to give any kind of literature which becomes the dominant, but eventually it gives a wrong hypothesis or a wrong conclusion of the literature which is produced. So
mm-hmm.
such kind of examples. But when I came here,
mm.
of course here all the freedoms are established, institutionalized, and we have that privilege. But our status is different, Dr. Umar, because we are, as you say, scholar at risk, or a scholar in exile, or I say fugitive scholar. So when we are in this category, it means we are still enrooted in our society, and the risk is a kind of extended to all our belongings back in our country. It is like you are suffering from diabetic. You are sitting on the table with all kinds of food, but you cannot mm. eat it because you know that you have a destructive forces inside yourself.
Sure.
That is why there are certain limitations. We know that if we talk about it or if we discuss about it, the risk which is maybe nowadays removed from ourselves individually will make suffer to all those our belongings back home. So I think that is same with almost every one of us. I'm mm. sometimes seeing my friends, they want to talk so dearly about Afghanistan's ground realities, but since they have kind of relations or kind of engagement with Afghanistan, they somehow try to self-censor themselves not to talk about it.
Sure. Now, Bashir, to what extent you agree with this proposition that, or you have faced the same situation, to self-censor yourself, either here in the U.S. or in Afghanistan, given under the Republic era or later on? Of course, you didn't leave under the Taliban, give me your sense. How do you see academic freedom in two different countries?
Well, I guess we are talking about academic freedom under the Republic regime.
That's right.
Rather than Taliban.
Yes.
And certainly the Taliban are no comparable to the Republic regime in terms of academic freedoms, because we were able to publish about whatever topics we wanted to publish. Overall, you had academic freedom in Afghanistan as well. But there were some rules that are not necessarily some constitutional principles or laws by the that are ratified and adopted by the legislator, but basically by the chancellors of different universities and the leadership of different universities, that to some extent limited the academic freedom of the faculties and scholars at different public and private universities. But there were some limits to it, even during the Republic regime. So I'm going to just give you a couple of examples to demonstrate what I'm trying to suggest.
Sure. Yes.
One example is, well, to me, academic freedom is also the freedom of having access to primary sources, to information, and things like that. And that was to a large extent limited. So, for example, I had a research project about the issue of discrimination in Afghanistan. And what I needed for that particular research project was to have access to cases that are supposed to be public that were on the issue of discrimination against the people of different communities by the government administrators and leadership of different government sectors.
Sure.
And it was... So, but we also had the law on access to information. I'm not sure what the exact title of the law was, law about the fact that the members of media and academics could have law that guaranteed the right of the journalists, the reporters, and the academics and researchers and all citizens of Afghanistan to have access to the documents that are public and produced by the government, and to have access to archives of different sectors in the government. But despite all that, it was the Supreme Court that did not allow me to have access to those cases that were supposed to be public and to use that for my research project. And they had different reasons, but really those reasons didn't matter at all because I didn't have access to the information that I needed to. And this, on the issue of self-censorship, one good example to me is, for example, I know of a lot of scholars, and in fact many scholars, who have come to the conclusion that a religious state or an Islamic state is not working for Afghanistan. They're pretty much in favor of a secular system and regime in Afghanistan.
Mm.
But by and large, a lot of scholars tend not to argue about it in the public, tend not to produce any research project about it, tend not to write an op-ed, or by and large, a lot of these scholars who do not think that a religious state or an Islamic state, any kind of Islamic state, republic, we have tried all different types of Islamic state. Remember, we have tried socialist Islamic state in Afghanistan, liberal Islamic state in Afghanistan, democratic Islamic state in Afghanistan, extremist Islamic state in Afghanistan. We have had over 12 draft and ratified constitutions, all of them referencing to the Islam as the religion of the people and religion of the state. And none of them actually succeeded in building a sustainable state in Afghanistan. And many of scholars are aware of this, but they do self-censor on this particular topic only because it's not popular in Afghanistan. By and large, the population of Afghanistan are in favor of an Islamic state, but then they differ on what that Islamic state has to be. the Talibanic Islamic State is one type, the Ghani Islamic State is a different type, and probably someone else's Islamic State is a totally different type of Islamic State. And that's why whatever interpretation of an Islamic State you adopt, you're eventually excluding a large population of the country. That basically buys troubles for the future of the constitution and the state. But again, not many scholars, although they understand it and they know it and they express it when they are in discussion with each other, but they are not putting it in words or in on papers just because it's not popular.
Okay. And then apart from academic freedom, about status of your discipline or your work on Afghanistan, how and what other aspects do you think that the fall of Afghanistan, the Taliban, impacted the nature of your discipline, political science or law, IR or political science, and the way you engage research now with the country? Of course, one big thing which comes to my mind is of is access to the field, which is totally impossible to a large group of scholars. Though I understand that there are Western scholars who still have access to the country, they can visit and do their full work.
Yeah, so it has had enormous negative impact or adverse impact on and disciplines that I have engaged with. So, for example, legal studies or legal education. The Taliban abolished the constitution. They have a totally different idea of what state law has to be. For them, it's a Sharia law, and then they have their own extremist interpretation of Sharia law. And therefore, it makes legal education almost redundant. And legal study is very difficult in Afghanistan because the only type of laws that you have to study in Afghanistan is the Talibanic extremist type of law that are right now implemented in the country. And on the issue of sociology and, for example, political sciences, different disciplines, again, what I've noticed since 2021 is that a lot of scholars from different areas who have, for example, studied institutional design, state building, international relations, for example, or constitution and societies in different communities in Afghanistan, they have almost all have basically shifted their focus on trying to understand, explain, and publish about what is extremism, what is radicalism, what is terrorism. So basically, and that includes me. So for example, my expertise is mostly constitutional design and divided societies with a particular focus on Afghanistan. So I've been mostly producing research and papers on the issue of electoral systems, democratic institutions, presidential systems, and centralization, and so on. But since the Taliban took over, I wanted to engage with the literature on the issue of radicalism, extremism, and why the Taliban were able to take over the country. So for now, it's good in terms of explaining what has happened in Afghanistan and explaining the return of the Taliban. But in the long term, it has an adverse impact on these different disciplines, because in a post-Taliban Afghanistan, we need scholars in different areas who can help us, for example, in terms of building democratic institutions, the constitution, for example, and re-engage their own areas of expertise so that, a post-Taliban Afghanistan is a better, a more sustainable state, and not the one that everyone is just experts of extremism and radicalism and terrorism, and then we have no one to help and work with us on constitutional designing, building democratic institutions, and so forth.
But it doesn't also matter if as a scholar, I mean, it matters. You can study Taliban and their laws. There's no problem with that. That is an issue area that you as a scholar, if you're neutral, it doesn't matter if it's Taliban or non-Taliban. That is the case that you have to explore it, unpack it, analyze it, and any sort of it's a nature of authoritarian. It's an authoritarian state, and there are many scholars who study authoritarian states. So, do you think there's a problem in studying Taliban or not?
I don't think it's a problem now, but what I'm thinking in the long term, that we need scholars in different areas, different experts in different areas, so that in a post-Taliban Afghanistan, they all contribute in their own areas. Most all Afghan scholars, whether legal, political, or sociology scholars, if they all focus on extremism, then there is a whole area of expertise that we need in a post-Taliban Afghanistan that won't exist then. So I did write about the Taliban laws and extremist rules because I thought it was very important to highlight and spotlight, you know, what's going on in Afghanistan. But at the same time, I have to get back to my own area of expertise in terms of, for example, constitutional designing, democratic institutions and things like that, so that if a post-Taliban situation happens, I'm able to contribute. And so I think that all other scholars need to contribute in their own areas.
Sure. So that leads me to ask another question, which is about ethical issues of studying a totalitarian regime like the Taliban. You expressed your concern, Dr. Balkhi, about how discipline of IR, from your standpoint, is not able to explain the regime. It's a unique case, which is quite different from the other countries, like in the neighboring countries of Afghanistan even. But how about certain ethical dilemmas for academics and scholars who study and engage with a regime, with the Taliban? Studying a regime like Taliban may at certain level require you to engage with the regime, to stay in, for probably require their permission to access the field, to access your interlocutors in order to interview, or, for example, access to information. Do you think these all will pose certain ethical dilemmas, and if so, how can we overcome them?
Let me take from the earlier answer that I gave into you. See, the totalitarianism of the Taliban is kind of deleterism. You will have different kind of totalitarian regimes. Some of them may be ideologic, and they are kind of producing justifying literature for their own approaches for their own countries or state or even global politics. In Afghanistan, it is all a matter of how to delete anyone who is not pro their approach inside Afghanistan. So that is why here you are facing a dilemma. If you are somehow try to study Taliban based on realities, based on facts, based on different characteristics, which is maybe in the society of Afghanistan, in the political culture, or different subcultures in Afghanistan, then you do not have that option to go on the ground and study it and interview the Taliban or doing a survey or any kind of data you cannot collect. But if you want to kind of study and justify, which is not ethic again, then of course you will be given a space inside Afghanistan to go alongside the Taliban and producing kind of literature that you are somehow not touching the ground realities, but somehow trying to play with words, which does not add to the scholarship from Afghanistan. That is why nowadays I'm working on the social thinking of the Taliban. So I believe that we have overlooked this angle or this aspect of understanding of the Taliban, how socially they are formed in Afghanistan from the different social fields of the country. So if you take me, if I go to Afghanistan, if I can have any kind of chance, with no risk, with guarantee I go to Afghanistan, the kind of questions, the kind of queries that I have from the Taliban commanders or soldiers or leadership, I cannot dare to ask them, because they know that these kind of questions are kind of negating their core values or core principles. So easily or simply, they can remove you with no any responsibility. So that's why what I believe is here we are in between the ethics and also responsibility, that we have to understand an issue on the ground, but at the same time we have to keep our ethics at the same time. So what I believe is that in such circumstances, such kind of situation, maybe there are limitations, maybe there are some obstacles, hindrances that we cannot do an overall study of an aspect or an issue in Afghanistan. But minor specific topics based on nowadays the media is a good example or a good source of data collection, and thanks God I always say that the Taliban is also exposing themselves so much in media. So based on that kind of data, we can at least do our own research based on ethics to produce a genuine scholarship on such a specific topic.
Good. So how about you, Dr. Mubashir? So in terms of ethical dilemmas that you are facing or you are observing that other scholars should observe when they are conducting a field research in Afghanistan?
Yeah, so I think objectivity is a core principle of doing science, including social science. It has different meanings for different scholars. Sometimes they conflate it, and therefore the dilemma of ethical issues with the studies arises. For example, to me, objectivity means the absence of biases. So,
sure.
For example, when you're entering into a lab to do biology or a chemistry lab, or for example, if you're starting a social science research project, what you need to do is to set aside your religious beliefs, your ethnic biases and prejudices, your linguistic and even political biases. You just have to do science, let the data, let the evidence, let the information lead you to the conclusion. And that conclusion may actually surprise you, let alone someone else. And the science is not about popularity. It's not about whether someone's like it or not. It's about finding the truth, right? And explain it honestly and sincerely.
Sure.
So to me, that's what science is. But if you think of doing science and studies as a neutral, in a sense that we remain neutral to, for example, atrocities that are happening by the Taliban, or we think of science as a value neutral in a sense that it is free of ethics and free of morality, I think that's a wrong approach to take to science.
Mm.
For example, just because of science you can produce chemical weapons doesn't mean you have to use it on people and kill people, right? Or just because you're looking for a treatment for cancer, you can just do experiments on people so that you get to your objective. So there are some ethical principles that every science person or person of scholars have to abide by.
Sure.
And one of those ethical principles is to look at, what is the benefit of my studies to the general community and to the society. So, for example, the issue of human rights, the issue of inclusion, the issue of democracy, are core principles on almost all universities. Inclusivity is a very cornerstone principle in any academic institutions that you look at, whether it's United States, Canada, or everywhere in the world. So to me, science is not necessarily free of ethics and morality, and we have to stick with those universal ethical and moral principles.
So how do you see this in context of Taliban now?
In the context of Taliban, I do not see that there is any sort of a gap or contradiction between your endeavor to do social science and to do your studies and your activism to basically enlighten the international community of what's happening in Afghanistan and the atrocities that are occurring because of the Taliban and by the Taliban, that there is no contradiction between the two. I think they actually complement with each other. And I do believe that doing one without the other is actually is flawed and it's not complete.
And let me lastly ask both of you one more question at the end, and that is, what would be your advice to Afghanistani scholars who are in North America or English-speaking countries, how they should navigate their way in academia and job market? And secondly, what would be your advice to the universities, institutions who support these scholars and provide them placement, fellowships, or other sort of institutional support? Based on your experience, what would it be? So first, Dr. Balkhi.
I believe, at least for scholars from Afghanistan, I would not say about other scholars in exile, because everyone has an individual case. It has to be a reciprocal process for long term to join academia in the US, because first of all, from the scholar side, I believe if there is a specific orientation for a long-term view, so that suppose I'm out of the country and I have the privilege of having institutional support for 2 years, and then after 2 years, you do not have any guarantee that you can return back to your country, for example, cases like us. In such condition, I think it would be better for those others. We did not do this. That's our failure part. Maybe for others, I can advise that from the beginning, they can have an oriented policy, so that eventually he has to join academia in the US. So for that, there are certain criterias, I think certain focuses that they have to go that path. And on the other side, from the institutional supports, I believe that they have to have also a category of different scholars at risk. There are some countries, they have short-term conflict, and eventually they have political peace, transition, or something like that. They have more spaces to return. But those countries, they have long-term conflict, and the situation is kind of not predicting. For that, I think the institutional support has to be continued, because after 2 years, as we all talked about it, after 2 years, when we get some of the familiarization of the new environment and new methods and skills, then we are all set free now to find our own path. Though the competition on academia has been always tough in the US, because US is a hub for academia, at least for 60, 70 years. And beside that, we are still suffering our obstacles with us. Still, we are in the post-trauma, post-collapse trauma, or for example, emotional failures that we have experienced.
Well, I think when the transition to the United States or Europe or Canada requires a lot of learning and unlearning. And what do I mean by that? And it does take a lot of time. Just to give you an example, based on the Afghan culture, it's almost prohibited to promote yourself, to sell yourself and to say, you know, that I did all these great things.
Right.
So I'm a really good candidate. Mm-hmm. So I have to get the job, and you have to recognize me as an important person. Mm. You don't do that in the Afghan context. If you do that, then nobody likes you, right? But in the United States, it's very important for finding a job. You have to sell yourself. You have to sell your products, and you have to tell them that you have done all these great things, and you have to actually exaggerate on them.
Mm.
And that's a cultural thing. So I've been struggling a lot about this, you know, how to basically decode myself from that particular culture where I just, throughout my lifetime, I just avoided promoting myself or advocating for myself, or for example, selling myself. Obviously, I had to advocate for myself, but selling
again,
myself in the
freezing
job market, where in the United States, it's very important, and it's the academic jobs are very competitive. So if you don't do that, there are many other people who are going to, you know, promote themselves,
right,
and sell their products. And if you don't do that, you're not going to get recognized, and someone else is going to get that. But that all that takes time, because it's a matter of habit, it's a matter of value, it's a matter of cultural issue, right? Or a cultural understanding of things. So that it cannot happen overnight. And I've been struggling about this like for 2-3 years now. The other thing is like the issue of networking. Networking is very important in the US context. If you want to find a job, you first have to network to important people in the job market on that particular area. Afghan culture, it's not that, you know, it's not that regular or normal. So I, as an Afghan, didn't do a lot of networking in Afghanistan. I didn't have a lot of network in the United States. So I was missing all that. And it, again, to get back to get to this game of networking, it takes a lot of time.
Mm.
So my advice for Afghan scholars and academics and fellows is basically to first study your universities, right? There are a lot of opportunities in terms of internship, externship, for example, and some funding for research projects. Just try to learn about those opportunities and apply for those opportunities and try to get some of those opportunities. And they're all very competitive. And secondly, try to do networking. Reach out to your professors. Do not just meet them inside classes and then that's it. Try to meet them in their offices, outside, have some coffee with them. They are pretty much open. And that's something that, you know, I had no idea. Like, if you approach your professor, it's very much likely that they're going to say, yes, let's meet and let's talk. And I always thought, no, the professors are busy. They have a lot of projects. They have a lot of classes. They're doing a lot of other stuff. So they may likely tell me, you know, no, I don't have time, so let's not meet. But almost always when I asked the professor to meet, they were there, they were available, and they were very well welcoming to meet students and colleagues. So those are my advices for Afghans and Afghan scholars. And my advice for the international academic institutions, including those of the United States, is that, you know, I think I just have to echo what Dr. Balkhi suggested. I know many scholars, Afghan scholars, who are no longer doing, you know, academic jobs. They are no longer doing research. They are no longer producing articles or books. They're totally doing different types of jobs only because they don't have an opportunity.
Mm.
And I think it's not only harming these scholars, these Afghan scholars, because they love their job, they love to do research, but they just can't do it because they have to feed their family and there's no opportunity for them here. But I think it also has adverse effects for the host community, host society, like United States and so on, who do not take the advantage of these prominent scholars, their area of expertise, but it also has adverse effects for Afghanistan as well, because these scholars are no longer using their brains and their scholarship and their knowledge to produce better quality research about Afghanistan.
Well, I think with that we come to the end of this podcast. If you have anything to add, I would like to thank both of you for your time to appear on this, and thanks to our listeners for listening to this episode. I hope you enjoyed listening to both Dr. Balkhi and Dr. Mubashir. Please subscribe to the podcast and make sure to share it with your friends on social media. I will be looking forward to talking to you and connecting back to all of you on the next episode.